week of July 5th, 2020, this is Showbiz Sandbox, episode 501, the podcast that brings you all the dirt on the news making headlines around the entertainment world. In Los Angeles, I'm Jay Sperling Reich.
And in Armonk, New York, I'm Michael Giltz.
Oh, geez, what's in Armonk, New York?
Why so dour? I could have said White Plains, New York. Nobody really knows where the song Frosty the Snowman is set. But Armonk, New York claims that right, and they have a parade every year celebrating Frosty. So I'll go with that one. Big news on the Frosty front. There is going to be a new feature film about Frosty the Snowman, and they've announced the actor who's going to do the voice work for Frosty. Perfect casting, Jason Momoa.
Wait, how is that perfect casting? I don't know if he's ever seen snow.
It's insane. It's the worst casting imaginable. Like, how is Jason Momoa in any way, shape, or form say to you, Frosty? It's like, and even if he doesn't look like Frosty, he's a big, huge guy. Maybe his voice is like Frosty the Snowman. Like, you would be better casting of Frosty than Jason
Happy
Momoa.
Happy birthday!
Exactly.
Isn't that how that the animated version opened? Yeah.
Exactly. I love it. I don't like it when voice acting is very lazy, the casting of it, and they go with just big name stars like Brad Pitt did voice acting in an animated film. I'm like, Brad Pitt's not a good voice actor. And it wasn't a successful film.
What was the name of that? I kind of vaguely remember.
Yeah, I'm forgetting now. I shouldn't have mentioned it. You'll have to look it up while I'm talking. But yeah, they cast Jason Momoa. I love voice work. I don't mind seeing celebrities go into voice work, but it means a lot of great talent that doesn't otherwise get work is shut out. We've had a lot of talk about people of color playing people of color. I think Frosty the Snowman should be played by a person of snow.
By the way,
I'm not mocking that. I'm just saying somebody who actually embodies Frosty, not Jason Momoa. Come on.
Cool World. And it was like, wasn't it like part?
No. That's a Ralph Bakshi film. That's a different movie. I believe it was a live action person in there, but that's a film with animation in it, but that's not what we're talking about. It may even be an all animated film, but that's not the one. It's like a Sinbad the Sailor type movie. Keep looking.
Okay. Jeez.
It's a little bit before that. It's probably before that. It's in the 90s. I think it's like a DreamWorks movie or something, or some third party.
I can't remember all these movies.
Can't find it? All right. So that's, Jason Momoa. Poor casting for Frosty the Snowman, but we do a good job casting our show because who's on it this week? Us.
Yes. Well, now let me ask you this big question. You asked me a while back, hey, do you think that Disney paid too much for Hamilton? $75 million to broadcast Hamilton, but first they were going to release it in movie theaters. They decided not to do that because they didn't.
Pandemic.
The pandemic. There's no movie theaters that are open. I still think they would have made a mint if they had released it in theaters. They would have made. They would have made at least $100 million off of it in theaters. I can tell you the number of people that signed up for, I mean, I know at least 10 people that signed up for Disney Plus just to watch Hamilton this past week. And now I don't know whether they'll stick. I don't know whether they'll stick around. But if you check Twitter or Facebook over the weekend, at least here in the US, boy, a lot of people were watching Hamilton.
It was a big draw, and it would have been fascinating to see how much money it made in movie theaters. They sure paid a lot of money for it, but bringing new people to their website, that was a guaranteed draw, and especially with the exclusivity, it may end up being good advertisement for them. And again, anybody who didn't sign up, they certainly heard that Hamilton was playing on Disney Plus. So all that free advertising pays off down the road too. It was, in fact, Sinbad, Legend of the Seven Seas from 2003. That's who Brad Pitt voiced with him and Catherine Zeta-Jones and Joseph Fiennes and other people. It was a film cast with people who were not necessarily all good voice actors. Oh, well.
Or even, written what? By people who don't. I mean, I don't even remember that movie.
Well, no, neither do I. I'm not saying it was a good movie, but the voice talent already let us know. I don't know about that. But what's going to happen on our show this week?
Well, this week on Showbiz Sandbox, we are still pretty much exhausted, okay, from all the parties surrounding our 500th episode. It was like the Oscars. We had to hit the Vanity Fair party. We had the gifts, the phone calls, the telegrams, which, by the way, Telegram? Really?
Yeah, that wasn't easy. Well, hat tip. That wasn't easy.
I mean, the carrier pigeons, all the well-wishers. It's just too much. I mean, thank you to everyone for making it so special. And thank you to the Hollywood Bowl for hosting our socially distanced after party. That was very nice of you. And what a coincidence. It wasn't booked for any events on the day we held our little shindig there. So it's a tight show this week. No guests, no banter. Okay, maybe a little banter, but still. And a rundown of the news as Hollywood tackles social justice and the pandemic. And I don't know if there's anything else going on. Well, I guess there's some acquisitions we can talk about. On Inside Baseball, we'll take a brief look at whether the movie theater chains and studios are starting to panic. Of course, during Big Deal or Big Whoop, we'll discuss some of the week's top headlines. But first, as always, we turn it over to entertainment journalist extraordinaire Michael Giltz to fill us in on last week's video on demand charts. I think let me just do this for you. Hamilton, number one.
Well, no, because that's not on the video on demand charts.
Well, it is. It's just SVOD, which does not hit a chart, by the way. So,
but it's not. It's not. It's an exclusive to Disney Plus.
Right.
It's not available for streaming video. Streaming video on demand is a movie that you can rent, but you have to pay $20-25, a premium price for. Right. Oh no, I'm sorry. I thought you were talking about premium video on demand.
Yeah, no. The SVOD is subscription video on demand, and those are not tracked at all because, as you say, they're all exclusive.
And they don't provide any information. That's right. So we don't know how many people streamed it this week. Disney does, and they're probably having a great Monday. But we have a chart. These are the most popular movies in standard video on demand, flicks where you pay $3, $4, $5 to watch them. It's the North American charts only. And there are two new films on the list, I think. The order has mostly the same. The Invisible Man is number one. The Hunt is number two. Jumanji, The Next Level, is number three. Bad Boys for Life is number four. And then we have a new flick. It's Burden. Is this the...
It's the a Universal KKK film.
Is that the movie with the KKK movie?
No,
like,
you mean...
Andrew Heckler movie where Garrett Hedlund and the museum opens, a museum celebrating the KKK opens up. Is that the movie we're talking about?
I have no idea. I can't imagine that would, well, maybe it would do well. Well, enough.
Garrett Hedlund and Andrea Weisberg and Forrest Whitaker. That's from 2018. It opened in Canada on June 9th of 2020. So yeah, probably played the festival circuit or something. It opened in Canada. So yes, I think that's the film we're talking about. That's a movie about when a museum celebrating the KKK opens up in a South Carolina town, tensions rise.
You think?
So, yeah. So that was not a shocker. At number six is Sonic the Hedgehog, then Call of the Wild, 1917, the best film on this list, Avengers Endgame, and then Onward, the Pixar film. That's back at number 10. So very little happening in the video on demand charts. Again, it's a very tiny snapshot of some movies available to some people and how popular they are. But like you said, the big story this week would have been Hamilton, but that ain't the mix. And, we're all wondering, when are we going to get back to a big wide release? We know the studios have said, okay, Mulan and Tenet, those will come out in August. Deadline now reports that studios are nervous about those August releases getting pushed back.
Well, they're nervous because of what's happening in the United States, which is, you know, lots of infection. The infection rate is going up, not down the way it is in other countries. And if that happens, you've got the governor of and the mayor of Los Angeles and the governor of California closing bars and restaurants and now movie theaters at least for 3 weeks. So the question is, will movie theaters be open in time for a Tenant on August 12th? I think they will be. But this country better get its act together.
Well, I don't know why you think they will be.
I just think, I don't know. I think
you're just wishful thinking.
Yeah, pretty much. I'm just wishful thinking.
I don't think studios and exhibitors should be nervous about August. I think they should be nervous about December.
Yes, that is true.
I'm serious. Yeah, August is not happening. September is not happening. Who is going to put out a $200 million film knowing that at any minute the plug may be pulled and your theatrical run is going to end? We're going to talk about this in Inside Baseball, but I think you got to hope. Are we going to open at any point through the rest of the year? Is any studio going to commit a film for a wide release knowing that any minute the biggest markets in this country may pull the plug? Is China opening up again? The biggest, second biggest market in the world? Is that happening?
So, well, you know what?
There's so many things, and we're not going to be able to cover them here, but let's get to our coronavirus update. Cinemark, we said last week, Karen corrected us. We had thought Cinemark was going along with Regal and AMC saying, yes, we will enforce masks. But they said, no, we're not. We're requesting it. We're encouraging it, but we are not insisting. Then they said, okay, never mind. Yeah, you will have to wear a mask. So all the big chains are on the same page. They are all saying that if and when we open up, moviegoers will have to wear a mask. That makes sense. You're in a room for a long period of time in an enclosed space with other people. You should wear a mask. View and Cineworld, however, they have delayed their openings in the UK to July 31st, just like we're seeing in the US.
And the UK opened up this past week. However, if you're a major circuit, there's no reason to open up. You've got no new movies. You'd have to be open for a month before new movies even begin to show up. And you're just losing money. You're basically
you want to open up like a 10 days or 2 weeks before a big movie.
That's exactly what they're doing.
Well, that's what they're thinking. Then they'll push that back again. They are opening up in Georgia, however.
Okay.
Well, not our Georgia, not Atlanta, Georgia, but Georgia, the country.
Oh,
Georgia,
okay.
The former Soviet Republic, along with Norway, Denmark, and other territories are opening up. They will have caps, of course, on attendance and things like that. But countries that have gotten a handle on it or think they've got a handle on the pandemic, they are opening up their movie theaters. But that's not happening here. We've talked about other awards. The SAG Awards will also be postponed. Every award you can name is going to be postponed.
Yeah, so they're postponed until March of 2021. Following suit with the Oscars. Yeah. They just kind of
And the Golden Globes and every single award will get pushed. The Spirit Awards, everything is getting pushed. CAA is pushing back. They will not return to their offices until at least 2021. Nobody's going to go back to work regularly at CAA offices in New York, LA or Nashville until January.
I wonder how much a part of that is they don't want to pay the rent on those. I'm sure they're paying the rent, but
they have to pay the rent. What do you mean?
Well, there's negotiations with every landlord for all office, all commercial space is up for negotiation at this point. But that said,
landlords are not going to say, oh, fine, keep your offices and come back when you want and pay rent when you want.
The question of whether there's a reduction of rent during this time period, certainly movie theaters are doing that. Trying to get out of a month or two of rent during this time period.
I don't believe that CAA's move is a play to, force owners of their office spaces to cave on rent. I think it's just a decision that they've made. Yeah, we're not going back to work.
Well, also, I mean,
that will provide pressure on them, but that's just a reasonable decision at this point. Sundance, they're firing people, 13% of their staff.
Well, Sundance, hold on a second. Let's talk about
virtual Sundance. They're having a virtual Sundance in 20 cities, but they are also laying off 13% of their staff. Do you like the plans that they're making?
I think it's very interesting what they're doing because they would have been the first. Okay. Everybody said, well, okay, Toronto may try to happen. Venice may try to happen. Telluride, they insist they're happening. Telluride, I could see happening because it's so small, and it's very difficult to get to. Great festival, but just, it's located in an inconvenient spot for travel.
Doesn't matter where it's located. Nobody wants to travel to a film festival. Doesn't matter.
That's part of, but so a lot of people were wondering, well, what's going to happen with Sundance next year? That's the first big American festival. And that they kind of answered the question. They said, we know we cannot have the same festival we had this year. We are not thinking outside the box. We are throwing the box away and we're going to start from ground zero and figure out a way to do this. We don't know what it's going to be yet, but we want everybody to give us ideas and it's going to be a virtual. It's going to be physical. So it's going to be spread across 20 different cities, as you say, including possibly Mexico City. And they're going to bring their platform not only to Park City in Utah, but to 20 different places at least throughout the country and possibly the world. Certainly, there's going to be an online element as well. This is going to be interesting.
It's not, because what if theaters aren't open? So it's a lovely thought. They have the Sundance Cinemas, of course, as well, which would have been a natural first place.
I don't think they own those anymore.
No, they don't own those anymore. But yeah, Sundance has always said, hey, we want to bring our movies to the world. This is nice. Instead of you coming to us, will come to you, but it's all premised on the idea that people will be comfortable and willing to sit in a movie theater for hours on end watching films. That you want to spend 8 hours a day in a movie theater with other people breathing the same air? That's a recipe for disaster. It's not even like you're going there for 2 hours to watch a movie. If you go to a Sundance Film Festival, you might be watching four movies in a day.
Well, right,
or three,
five.
Or two. Or,
yes, yeah, I do.
Even this will be different and say, hey, what movies relate to your city? What makes sense for your area? They'll also be making films available online That's clearly, they're saying, look, we can't, you can't come to us. We've got this fakakta idea that people will sit in theaters around the country and breathe the same air and see movies. But we know that we can make our movies available in a secure way online. And that's the future for Sundance at the moment, that they will be making their entire festival slate available to press and other people online. That's where Sundance is going to happen. It's not going to be this, well, we'll have it in movie theaters and people will go and they'll sit and breathe the air. And do they mean it's supposed to be festival goers or it's supposed to be just regular folk?
No, festival goers. They'd have to,
right.
You know.
Right.
Well, here's the thing. Yeah. You know, you asked about the layoffs. I think they're just, well, you know, it's a shame.
They're running out of money.
Yeah. They're running out of money and they're looking at their sponsors who are also running out of money and saying, we can't sustain this. There's no way we can, we're not going to make
as much money.
Yeah. Right. And by the way, Alamo Drafthouse, same thing. They turned a good percentage of their furloughs into actual layoffs where they said, okay, it's no longer a furlough. It is officially a layoff. And some really high up, some of the, you know, their creative director, Mike Sampson, who, you know, is basically responsible for all the creative stuff that Alamo Drafthouse does inside their theaters, gone. That's just remarkable to me. Now, the goal is that once they open up and there's revenue, that they'll be able to hire some of these people back. But there is no guarantee that those people will still be available.
No, of course not. They've got to make a living. But nobody can pay employees' salaries when there's no money coming in. That's why in other countries, the government stepped in and said, we are going to pay 80% of everyone's salary. We're going to keep everyone in place, or 70% or 75%. We're going to make sure these businesses don't go out because it's a lot more expensive to let companies collapse. I don't mean restructured bankruptcy. I mean actually go away for good. It's a lot more expensive to have companies disappear, people be out of work, people get evicted from their homes, and then you have to clean up that mess. It's a lot cheaper and smarter to say, when we get back to normal, there's no reason Sundance and Broadway and a local hardware store and whatever it may be could have its business resume. But if we don't help them stay in place, they're going to collapse. So other countries are doing it smarter. We're not doing that here.
Wait. Other countries are doing this pandemic smarter than we are?
Yeah, apparently.
Color me shocked.
Yes. Well, the cable news networks, they're doing it smart. They're having a great time. They are having their highest rated quarter ever.
In history.
Yeah, well, ever, yes. The pandemic may be bad for the country, but it's good for cable news. Remember quote?
Yeah. I find that, you know, the cable news, I sometimes just wonder, they like stoke these things. And I'm not saying they're doing that here. I'm just saying, I found it very interesting that during the Black Lives Matter protests, they took down the coronavirus overlay, the count of how many infections and how many deaths. And as soon as the Black Lives Matter protests weren't getting any ratings anymore, they put it back up because they knew, oh, well, let's go back to something that it's almost like, really? Come on, guys.
Well, you know, and speaking of people losing their jobs and being desperate, they're not going to be ready to go back to Sundance if they need to get work. And people are risking their lives to go back to work because there isn't the support at the government level. Disneyland in California, they are delaying their opening. Disneyland Tokyo opened up with a 20% cap. Disney World in Florida, well, they had plans to open. Actors Equity says your safety plans are insufficient. There are zero testing for performers going back to work at Disney World. There are no plans to test anyone coming back to work at Disney World. All the people who go on stage, they're like, whatever, good luck, you know, be safe. And they said, we're telling people, don't go, do not work. Well, they're still planning a July 11th reopening, though I assume with Florida's numbers growing and growing, they may have to pull the plug on that, but that's only 6 days away. They say we expect 10,000 employees to show up, and no wonder, unemployment is running out in July. People are going to be homeless. They're going to go hungry. They have no choice. So even though their own union is saying this is not safe and their plan falls well short, and even though numbers are rising in Florida, what choice do people have? They're going to go back to work. They're going to march to work knowing they're risking their own health and the health of their family. And that's why major industries are saying, look, we are going to collapse. There will be no jobs available when we ever get back to normal. They need Congress to provide pandemic insurance. NASCAR, the NFL, Hollywood studios, unions, the theater industry, everybody's saying, look, if you want us to survive, if you want us to try to go back to work in any way, shape, or form, you got to step up. There's not an insurance company in the world that can provide us insurance right now. And if we need some backstop, and you're going to have to step in and do it.
And I noticed that, and I just scrolled down quickly, and maybe I just didn't see it, but Nick Cordero, 41 years old, Broadway actor, he died over the weekend. Complication. He's been in the hospital since March with coronavirus.
Oh, so yeah, he's been in a coma at some points. They amputated a leg while he didn't even know it. A months-long battle, they were talking about maybe a double lung transfer. That was the latest, the double lung transplant. That was what they were going to need to do so he could survive. It's been a horrific battle, and he lost that battle. He died at 41. Very sad. I've seen him on Broadway in Bullets Over Broadway, which he got nominated for. I would say he was the best thing in the show, but he was the only good thing in the show. He was in A Bronx Tale, Rock of Ages, he was in the Broadway one, but not the original cast, I don't think. He was in Waitress, but he was a good rising talent. His wife had a long campaign keeping people aware of the battle he was facing to try to get people to realize you need to take this seriously. So a sad loss.
And the fact is, you know, look, let's face it, you know, a lot of people are saying, well, you know, not everybody dies or not everybody gets the bad kind, but it's kind of like playing Russian roulette with 100 bullets, you know, or sorry, 100 chambers and one bullet. You never know when that one is going to be you. It doesn't matter whether you're 85 or 41. It could be you.
There's a big difference between dying and it's no big deal. A lot of people get very sick and don't die. They have all sorts of problems. They have big, huge hospital bills. You get in the hospital for 3 weeks, you're going to have a $30,000, $40,000 bill, depending on your insurance. Tom Hanks has his new movie, Greyhound, that's just debuted on Apple. It's getting solid reviews. I'd like to check it out. And he said, look, he described what he went through. He said, it was really, really difficult and unpleasant. It was not fun just because I didn't, you know, he's one of those people, he didn't die. He's like, believe me, you don't want to go through what I went through. And he describes it in detail. So check that out online. But people are trying to be positive. They're trying to look for good things. There are empty UK theaters. Designers are wrapping them in messages and artwork to try and, you know, the National Theater's been wrapped and they've done a cool thing there.
That's like, yeah, like the police tape. They take these pink police tapes that say missing live theater and they wrap them up in all different kinds of designs just because... I don't think it's to keep people away. I think it's
No. It's a statement. It's an artistic statement, of course. Yeah. And that happened at the National Theater just as people in the front of house and backstage were told they are being let go. I assume that means fired as opposed to furloughed
No. This is, we cannot pay you. If you find another job, please take it. You no longer have a job here.
The bummer is here in Birmingham, Alabama, where I am when I'm not in Armonk, New York, I'm in Birmingham, Alabama. And we had a great drive-in movie theater that I would go to regularly. And they went out of business like 6 months ago. I was like, son of a...
Talk about bad timing.
Yeah, I could have been going to movies all this time. But apparently we do have a Walmart and I'll be able to perhaps go see movies there.
Yeah, in the parking lot, though. Don't go in. That's not...
Well, I've been in Walmart. I wear a mask. I go in. They're very good about making sure you wear a mask. They don't mess around at Walmart. So good for them. But yeah, 160 Walmart parking lots, Walmart parking lots will become drive-in movie theaters. That's a great thing you can do. You know, you sit in your car, you play it on the radio, you don't have to be around anybody else, and you can watch a movie. So that's fun. It starts in August. It's going to happen all over the country. They're going to do it. You know, it'll be cool. It's going to tour through October. So that's fun to see. At least there's something interesting in thinking outside the box. Certainly the Academy of Motion Pictures Arts and Sciences.
The box? The big box store, you mean?
Yeah, there you go. What was it called in Wally World? Not Wally World, but in Wally? What was it? What's called? The big more? Buy more. Yeah. The biggest box of all. So the Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences, they're trying to think outside of the box. They invited another 819 new members. 49% of them are international. 45% of those invitees are women. 36% of them are ethnic or racially underrepresented groups. So they are making strides. But I would point out to you that with those numbers, that means a majority of them were American, male, and white.
And what I will say is
very hard to change those numbers after decades of misrepresentation.
There was a lot of both, we get it, but come on. After this announcement, and I was kind of trying to think about like what led to that, and then I looked at just the publicist category. Okay, so just the publicist, nothing else, and this is all I'm referring to. And I saw some of these publicists that I receive emails from, and I went back to two things. First, I went to my own email, and I said, "Well, I only started receiving emails from them like a year ago." Or no, 2 years ago. Okay, so the latest 2 years. And they're publicists for independent films. So that good on you. You know, that's what we want to see, not just studio content.
You're trying to say they're not worthy of being in the Academy.
And then I went back and I looked at LinkedIn and I said, wait, you graduated from high school like 6 years ago. Now you graduated from college and 2 years later, you're in the Academy.
People have been kept out of the Academy for decades. People have been kept out of the Academy when they were Oscar nominated or Oscar winners. So suddenly, as soon as they try to go, oh, people are getting in too easily. Relax. It's just the damn Academy. It's not the national letters. It's like people are there. If they're not active and they're not working, they will be pulled out again. They'll have better standards in terms of who's working and who's active and who gets to vote. Relax.
Remarkable to me? You know who was let in this year or who was invited in this year? Thierry Frémaux from Cannes.
Oh my God. Are you kidding me?
What? That's like.
Exactly. There's so much absurd examples of people being kept out insanely wrongly, just to an absurd level that, believe me, if they go a little far in the other direction, so what? So people need to shut up when they're like, oh, they don't deserve to be in. Nobody deserves or doesn't deserve to be in a stupid gang. It's just a gang. It's just a people having a club. So it's not, you know, some hollowed, august institution. It's just people who vote on the Oscars. So, you know, get over yourself. Fox News, they certainly got over themselves. They have fired another person for sexual misconduct. It's anchor Ed Henry on America's Newsroom. Apparently, he's been misbehaving. That makes it sound too flippant. When Fox News fires someone, you know they have to be bad, because they have a bad corporate culture there. Mad Men, they depicted a bad corporate culture at times, and knowingly so. The women treat dismissively, objectified, you name it. Well, they have a new streaming home. They're on Amazon, and they have added a disclaimer to an episode that includes blackface. And they point out, look, we're not using it lightly. We are showing the endemic racism of this era and how prejudice has been present all along, showing one character wooing another character by singing to her in blackface. And it wasn't done lightly or to make a joke or think, well, we're trying to make a point, but they used it in a way that was, no, they're like, no, we used it. We meant to use it. We're showing how common this was, and we are happy and comfortable with the context. And so here it is, but we've warned you. So there you go. And I watched the Golden Girls. I thought, what was the episode where they wore blackface? It turns out it's an episode where Dorothy's grandson is marrying or dating a woman twice his age. He's in his 20s and she's in her 40s. And Dorothy doesn't like that. She's twice his age. But her grandmother doesn't like it because the girl is black and the boy is white. And she's like, you're not dating any white. You know. So it's the tension between one caring about the race and the other one caring about the age. And Sue Ann Nivens, what's her name? Betty White and Blanche come out of the other room. They had mud masks on. They were doing beauty facial treatment. And the joke was that the woman was looking at them with a slant eye. What's going on here? What are you people doing? What the heck is this? You know? And so it wasn't, they were in blackface and they were making fun of the history of blackface and how they weren't. And, you know, so, you know, that needs to be erased forever. And you have a disclaimer on it, I think. Maybe I'm not sensitive enough. But I do think I agree with some of the people who say, look, let's not pretend these don't exist. Put them in context. Put a disclaimer. You know, maybe let's not use it so lightly in the future. The number of shows doing the last 10, 20 years is shocking in a way. But, you know, trying to pretend it never happened, I don't think that's good. That's what they do with Song of the South. I'd like to see Song of the South. I was 12 when I saw that movie, or 14, and I thought, wow, this is really not good. You know, yeah. I thought this is a bit much, as all the slaves are weeping and crying over the masses little boy getting sick. I'm like, well, really? You know, so sometimes it's good to see them and see how ridiculous they are. But there is good news, right? There's light at the end of the tunnel. CBS has a new pilot. It's called Ghosts. And the new lead, the male lead, is Pitch Perfect and Mindy Project actor Utkarsh Ambudkar. It's based on a British series. It's about a couple who inherit a dream home, only to realize it's a money pit, and if that's not bad enough, it's haunted by family relatives dating back centuries. I don't know this UK show.
This could be actually, that's a great premise. That could be hilarious.
You are such a Hollywood exec to think it's a great, nothing is a good premise. Show me the script, then I'll tell you whether it's a good premise. But this actor, Utkarsh Ambudkar, you'd recognize him if you saw him. He was born in Baltimore, the son of parents who emigrated from India in the 1980s. He's just a guy in a show. It's not a show about somebody with dark skin. It's not a show about anything. He just was the actor cast in the role, and his name is Utkarsh Ambudkar. You know, that's progress, people.
Yeah, well, better you than me having to say that, because I would have botched
it. Well, Giltz. Oh, I'm sure I botched it. I meant to look up how to pronounce his name, so I apologize how badly I butchered it. But believe me, people butcher Glitz and Giltz and Glitz all the time. That's why when I order food or put in my name at reservations and they say, "What's your name?" Thor. Thor is what I say.
Yes, actually,
they remember
you do.
They laugh and they always remember me, and they say very loud, "Thor, table of four, Thor." And they love it. They always remember you. They think I'm a big deal when I show up with that name.
Oh, okay. Well, then if you're a big deal at restaurants, it must be time for Big Deal or Big Whoop, our weekly segment where we discuss the top headlines in entertainment and tell you whether they're really important or just overhyped nonsense. You know, we'll discuss some of the top stories. Here's our first story. And this kind of, well, we'll see. Maybe there won't be a strike after all. What I'm talking about is the writer's strike. The Writers Guild of America has reached a tentative deal with Hollywood studios. It seems to follow the blueprint established by the Directors Guild, this pattern negotiating thing that we all knew would happen. It's got substantial increases in payments for streaming, bumps in pensions and healthcare, and annual salary raises to keep pace with inflation. There are major gains that include changes on how long writers can be forced off the market under an exclusive deal. The deal must be approved by members. This new contract must be approved by members, but it is expected to pass. Is this a big deal or a big whoop?
I think it's a big whoop. Once the pandemic struck, we knew that the Writers Guild Union had a lot of wind taken out of its sails. It's really hard to play hardball in an environment like this. True, the studios were in a hard position as well, but this wasn't going to be easy. We assumed they would get the basic gains achieved by the Directors Guild. That's exactly what happened. I think it's the best they could have done right now. And talking about the best you could do right now, a lot of deals have been announced, and they're all streaming deals. Apple is buying a Will Smith film called Emancipation. I think that was done at Virtual Con, which you said has been done really, really well. I wonder I would love an update on that. How's Virtual Con going? Have you dipped back into it again, or you just saw it once and thought it was cool?
I saw it once. No, I went the whole week, but cool. You know, the screenings weren't really open to press. Some were, some weren't. And I didn't have time to, you know, you had to go at a certain hour and you couldn't,
Trapped at home. How could you not have time?
Oh, no. I was doing also remember there's a huge time zone difference there as well.
Yeah. Right. So that was a hot property at Virtual Con, the Emancipation, about a man who was enslaved and escapes from the Deep South. Netflix bought the Aaron Sorkin flick, the starry film, The Trial of the Chicago Seven. And of course, Apple and Netflix are the big guys doing this because they're streamers. They don't care about box office. They may have box office penciled in into their business model, but basically they are built for speed in this period and they don't care. That's why they're buying Greyhound, which is releasing this week with Tom Hanks. That's why Disney Plus has Hamilton. That's why Apple is buying a Will Smith flick, which I feel like they paid way too much money for.
Apple paying way too much money.
Over $100 million for that story and that film. I wouldn't want to do that if I was just doing it at the box office. I feel like they're paying way too much money for that film, but it's a 1-2-hour movie. I don't think it's a good use of money. I'm not saying the movie won't be great.
Let me get this straight. New entrant into the film industry pays too much money for a property with a movie star. Yeah, that's never happened before in the history.
They should have paid too much money for the MGM library. They should have paid too much money for something that they could buy to fill up the shelf of Apple.
That's true.
We're waiting for them to do that for years now, and they didn't. And I don't know why, because that cupboard is bare. I want to watch Greyhound, but if you think I'm going to subscribe to Apple to do it, you're crazy, because they don't have anything I want to watch other than that. Their shows, some are like, oh, Dickinson's okay, or this is okay. Nothing is great, and nothing is, they do not have enough stuff for me to think I would want to rent it. In a week, I'd be done.
Well, speaking of being done, you know, the show must go on, but sometimes the show, well, it can't go on. During the pandemic, this is one of those times for the entertainment biz, and the UK government is now stepping in to help. After intensive lobbying, it announced, this is the government announcing it, about $2 billion in support for the arts, including the West End, the Broadway of London.
Which draws more people than Broadway, by the way.
Yeah. Museums, performing arts venues, indie cinemas, and the like. It includes $1 billion in grants, more than $300 million in loans, and more. So, you know, huzzah, say the company's getting a lifeline. That's a great first step, but is it a big deal or a big whoop, really, is the question.
It's a big deal, because if they hadn't done it, they were going to start shutting down right now. And people are being fired and laid off for good right now. So yes, it is a big deal, but it really is just a first step. These are hugely important industries, as are all the industry. You know, this is when you realize, hey, there aren't unimportant industries. You know, the hardware stores that keep people employed, the maids, everybody is important when, you know, everything is suddenly disappearing from the surface of the earth. But the arts really punches above its weight in the UK. They do a great job of providing hundreds of thousands, if not millions of jobs. They're really important, and they can't survive without government support. This keeps the lights on for a few more months, literally, but they're not going to be able to survive beyond that unless the government does a lot more. So they're in fact, Sam Mendes and Netflix and others are launching a fund, a $500,000 fund is the first money in it, to help theater people who don't qualify for government support. It seems to be for people who have fallen through the cracks for whatever reason. They're freelancers, or they're not considered staff, or whatever. They're people who work in the industry. They're very important, but they are falling through the cracks, and they have launched this campaign, and other people are chipping in as well to try and help them out. Now the government is helping out. We need that here in the U.S. as well. You know, Lincoln Center, the Metropolitan Opera, all the big theater companies, all the institutions around the country that provide so much jobs and are such great anchors in their communities, they're going to disappear unless the government steps up. I hope they don't behave like buttheads.
Oh, I get it, because, you know, I put this story in here about Beavis and Butthead being revived to Comedy Central. You know, they say revived to Comedy Central almost as if it was on Comedy Central. It was actually on MTV.
Right, and in this new version, they're going to be parents. They're going to be whatever they were, raising millennials. So that's the spin. They're going to have kids, presumably, even dumber than they are. Maybe their kids will be smarter. I don't know. All I know is I never really watched the show. In 5 minutes, I'm like, okay, yeah, I get it. They're making fun of videos. It's okay, whatever. And not a fan, didn't care. But obviously, Mike Judge, that's the creator, correct?
Yes, it is.
Yeah, he did great stuff in other areas. And, you know, they did the Beavis and Butthead movie, which for some reason I went to see Beavis and Butthead Do America. That was really quite good. Not a great film like the South Park movie, but that was a good, solid, funny film, to my astonishment. I don't know why they never made a sequel, but you know what? Given the new spin and them being parents, I might check it out.
Yeah, that I would like to see.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, I
was not a fan of the show necessarily.
Yeah, making fun of Slayer videos, it gets old. Yeah, right. Yeah. Well, they wouldn't make fun of Slayer. They would love Slayer. They would make fun of Toto or something. But, you know, that wraps up Big Deal, Big Whoop, and it brings us to Inside Baseball. That's where we analyze some of the headlines that have the entertainment industry buzzing. We'll explain what they mean for the business and, more importantly, how they affect you. We want to dip back into an issue raised by some of our listeners who have written into us or reached out via text or Facebook and raised some stuff. We went over a little bit of it over the last 2 weeks, but I wanted to raise it up again because at the top of the show, we were talking about studios and exhibitors are worried that those August release dates may not happen. I'm saying August? We're not going to be open in December. Who the heck is going to release a film, a $200 million movie, knowing that at any minute, the plug could be pulled in any market or across the whole country and their movie will be shut down? I mean, they just can't afford to do it. I don't think I wouldn't do it. I will be sitting on Mulan and Tenet until theaters are open again, and I do not have to worry that they're going to shut down in a week or two later. And that means a vaccine. And that could be years. Forget the end of the year. If we get it before the end of 2021, that will be great, unprecedented news in terms of creating a new vaccine from scratch. I don't think it's ever happened that fast.
No, history. 4 years, months.
Yeah, 4 to 5 years, right? Exactly. So people are saying to us, they're saying, all right, what's going on? And they ask you a question specifically. Sperling, you're in that circle of coverage talking to exhibitors. Are some exhibitors starting to freak out from your perspective?
Yes and no. And what I mean by that is you're never going to hear from the large exhibitors about what they're really thinking. But, you know, Cinemark said, we're fine through the end of the year. AMC said, oh my gosh, we're going bankrupt. They didn't say that, but, of course everybody believes they're going bankrupt. And they, you know, they do have a lot of debt. They've, they're taking on more debt and they've all delayed their reopening.
And my foolish Pollyanna nature says, if AMC goes bankrupt, somebody else will step in and keep those cinemas opening. They're too valuable. Even if the company over leveraged itself and collapses, those aren't going to shutter and disappear.
No,
but maybe
not
a reasonable. All right. Yeah. Okay.
Some will.
Well, everybody always overbuilds or whatever, but yeah.
I mean, there's been some speculation that they would file for bankruptcy if only
and
to
reorganize.
Get out of,
sure.
Well,
sure.
Yeah, if only to get out of, like, they bought Carmike Cinemas a couple years back. If they filed for bankruptcy, they could get out of leases that they just feel like, oh, you know what, we're not making any money at that venue. Let's just, we can't get out of the lease. Unless we file for bankruptcy, then we can get out of the lease.
But as long as you know so well, about half of the cinemas in this country are the three large chains. But that means about the other half of the exhibitors are mid-sized chains, smaller chains, and mom and pops. And those people are the ones that do not have deep
pockets.
They're hurting. They can't have a, are they freaking out?
They're either freaking out or just, you know, they're kind of resigned to, well, this is it. This is the end.
But can they survive?
Or they're saying, you know what, you know, because I'm so small, I have a relationship with my landlord. It's not, you know, an absentee landlord, absentee tenant type of situation. And they are making deals. They are trying to do the best they can. And a lot of them are saying, look, we're not going to open until we have new films. So if that's in August, great.
Everybody knows that. Yeah.
But frankly, you know what, at this point, just make it September. I've heard a number of exhibitors just say, you know what, you've lost the summer, so forget about it. Just wait until September, open in September. As far as whether people will go back, the infection rate does have to be below, you know, that R number that everybody talks about, where like if one person gets it, the number of people they then infect has to be below one. Meaning,
right.
You know, much like it is, by the way, in most of Europe, where the infection rate is one person gets it, they may not infect anybody. We have it and the infection rate is really high. And, you know, if you look at like Italy, 120 people per day, you know, that's
right. So these small cinemas, unless they can make a deal with their landlords, and frankly, their landlord has to recognize if they go out of business, who's going to step in to open up this theater? Right? There's nothing to do with a movie cinema other than show movies by and large.
No,
right?
I mean, some have been turned into, you know, retail stores. It's hard. It's very hard.
That doesn't work well. Yeah.
But
so they also want to know, what about studios? Do they have a contingency plan built around a worst case scenario? If you were a studio, what exactly would that be? I mean, obviously you could pivot to premium video on demand, but that's not a good market unless you're talking about mid and modest budget movies. Premium video on demand doesn't work for a $100 to $200 million movie by and large. Right, you're not going to want to do that premium video on demand.
No,
that's not a business model.
It works if you think, okay, you know what, we're going to make $50 million premium video on demand, and we're going to have to write off the rest. We'll, you know, at least make some money.
That's not working. That's just saying you've already sunk costs, but that's not a long-term plan. That's just, all right, I've got this movie because of various financial obligations. I can't wait anymore. That's when you sell Greyhound to Apple. That's when you go premium video on demand. But
well,
now
there's also financing issues there.
Right.
A lot of the financing contracts say you have to either
that can be renegotiated, and they say we can't release it theatrically, obviously. And they'll say, yeah, we don't want to wait 3 years to get our money. Let's move forward and get what money we can. So that's the short term solution. But what's going to happen? What's the other plan? What can they do? They can't even make movies.
Well, correct. They are starting to go back and make movies. Now, here's the real issue.
But I think that's going to get shut down too.
With making movies. So the problem is you've got, you know, the big studios, and then you've got pretty much the people in Cannes who are financing movies that get made and then picked up by the studios, or the studios come in later, or no studio comes out and then, you know, an independent distributor releases them. Those movies are almost impossible to make right now. The studios themselves can do what's called self-insure. They can insure their own productions.
Well, they're also lobbying Congress, at least in the United States, to say, hey, we want you to provide us insurance.
Much like happened after 9/11 for the airlines and things like that and other businesses. So the same is true now of the motion picture industry and the television industry. They're saying, look, we need some form of insurance. There's no way we can start a production and get financing from a bank, getting these, you know, bridge loans until we get insurance.
But
and
how,
we can't get
how
the insurance.
How is self-insurance going to work? Because you're going to start filming again, and you know what? You're going to get people sick. And they're going to have to shut down again. And if your lead actor or actress or support, you know, these people can't be replaced. You can replace a gaffer, but you cannot replace
I think they're going to say, look, everything is like summer camp now. It's like sleepaway camp. Everybody goes, they get tested, and they're quarantined in the hotel. Kind of like what they're doing with a little bit with Major League Baseball.
And it's not working. Day one of camp, two players in the Yankee camp tested positive, and Tanaka got hit in the head by a line drive and went to the hospital. You know, this is not, you know, you can say, well, everybody be responsible and we'll all behave and follow the rules. Well, it's not going to work unless they're in an isolated location and they can't go around other people and you really lock them down. Who's going to want to spend 6 months doing that on a TV show? You know, forget movies. What about a TV drama? You think people are going to stay isolated, truly isolated for 6 months to film an entire season of a TV drama? I don't think so.
Here's what I say. I say, bring some cots to the stadiums. Never let them leave the stadium. They'll be fine.
Right, but that's not going to happen. Millionaires are not going to be told you can't have a life. And actors and the people working on a TV show, it takes 6 months to film an entire season of like a network show. Or 4 months. You really think they're going to like truly isolate themselves for 4 months? If you force them to do it, they're going to be miserable and they're going to want more money.
Well, here's the thing. I think that, certainly production is hard. They're slowly starting to go back now here in LA. So, and they're not jumping into it. They've got a few productions that are going and they are going very slowly. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, they're taking your cautionary words in they're listening. Let's put it that way. As far as studios, there has been a question of, well, how much does it cost to remarket these every time they, you know, re-advertise, every time they delay a movie? To which I would say, yeah, it doesn't cost them much because they never started in the first place. And they have so much free marketing with everybody talking about Mulan and Tenet and Tenet, and Mulan and Mulan and Tenet and Tenet. You know, it's just like everybody knows these movies are coming out and when they're coming out and if they're coming out and when they've been delayed. I mean, it's like headline news. Most movies wish they could create front page headlines when they move their release date. So this is not something that they need to market. When they actually have a go date, yes, mm-hmm. they will market officially and you know, you'll see the marketing campaign. But as this the person who wrote to dirt@showbizsandbox.com, that's dirt@showbizsandbox.com, what they're saying is, hey, you know, these studios probably do have a contingency plan. Yeah, their contingency plan is premium video on demand
not for big movies. That's not for the movies you want to go to theaters to see automatically.
Yeah, it's
any movie can be popular at a theater. My Big Fat Greek Wedding can run for a year. But when we're talking about the big budget movies, the only game in town is a big screen with a bunch of people sitting in the theater. Right.
You know, it's funny because I watched Hamilton on a screen, 65-inch screen. This is no small screen. And the oldest person in the crowd in their 70s said, you know, that would have been great in a movie theater.
Oh, yeah? Well, yeah. How did you think? Well, you saw it on stage. So how did it play for you?
It played very good, actually. They did a very good job of filming it. You know, it was good. They mm-hmm. did a good job of capturing that
what
production.
Yeah.
And why it was so successful.
The talent.
The talent.
There's so many
songs.
Good breakout stars.
Production. Yeah, it was just perfect. Perfect moment in time.
Well, will the pandemic fundamentally change the industry? We know that movies were always being available day and date. Lots of indie films and docs were available online before they premiered in theaters or when they premiered in theaters or instead of theaters. But I still believe that fundamentally exhibition has not changed. People want to go to the movies. They want to sit in the dark, just like they do for Broadway and live concerts. Nothing can replace. Tenet will not be as much fun in your home watching it on a big screen than it would be in a movie theater. It just wouldn't. And people still want to do that. And I think 2 years from now, you get a vaccine, people are going to want to go back to the movie theaters. It remains a hugely important driver of the business. And I don't think that's going to fundamentally change.
You know, John Sloss, during the virtual can, he gave a keynote and he was asked about what's going to happen with theaters. And he was a little concerned about it, with movie theaters, that is. John Sloss is a very smart, very successful lawyer turned financier. He puts deals together, financing deals and independent film deals. He's a nice guy and just very, very well-spoken. And he said, you know, that when theaters reopen, the studios and distributors will likely need to come to the aid of cinemas. But at the same time, what will need to happen is that cinemas need, and you know, movie theater owners and operators need to give up on this 90-day window. There has to be a little give or take, to which I would say...
What does that have to do with anything?
Well, why spoken like a true financier. You know,
yeah,
like,
yeah, yeah. The 90-days window has got nothing. It's like, yeah, that way you can make tons of money, hundreds of millions or billions of dollars. Let's torpedo that.
Well, remember,
enough of that.
Keep in mind what kind of movies he's putting together. Okay, he's not putting together Avengers. He's putting together very successful independent films. Films that go on to make, lots of Christine Vachon's films, lots of Todd Haynes films, lots of John Sayles films. Right.
Movies that benefit tremendously from playing in a movie theater.
Well, what I would say is, okay, fine. You want to play it that way? Think about it this way. Another way to think about it is, reverse it. Say, okay, fine. You want to make it non-exclusive, the theatrical window non-exclusive? Fine. You can sell your film to Netflix, but only non-exclusively. Okay, you can't. In other words, it can play on Netflix and on Amazon. Now, how much is Netflix willing to pay for it now? Probably a little less, right?
No, much, much less.
Yeah.
No, they're not interested in having movies that you can watch anywhere. That's not the game they play. But so that's a non-starter. But I think again, I don't understand. If a movie flops and you're not showing it in theaters anymore, let them take it to video. You know, let them take it to video on demand. If the movie's playing in theaters, they shouldn't want to take it to video on demand. If they're never going to open wide, those deals are being made already. You know, that happens all the time. A small indie film opens up in New York and LA and on demand around the rest of the country. It happens every day. So it's already happening. So that mix is already in play for independent films, small films, documentaries. We do that now. We've been doing it for years. So his films, if they're big enough that they want to have a big wide release, you know, I don't get the problem. Either you want to make money at theatrical or you don't.
Well, you know what? You know who's not making money anymore?
Who?
Sadly. Ennio Morricone. Actually, his estate probably is making money.
He is indeed. He died at 91. He's one of the greats. He did the spaghetti westerns for Sergio Leone. They first met when they were about 8 years old. In like grade school. And then they didn't meet again for decades later, but they did cross paths as little boys. Isn't that awesome? So spaghetti westerns from Leone to The Hateful Eight for Quentin Tarantino. He's forever linked to that genre, though, of course, he did much more than that. And he proved great scores can be written for films that aren't that good, notably The Mission, the Roland Joffé stolid drama, one of his most acclaimed works, very popular in concert. I mean, the list of great movies, Days of Heaven, The Battle of Algiers, Bugsy, The Thing, the 1982 remake, La Cage aux Folles, Once Upon a Time in America. It just goes on and on and on.
Cinema Paradiso.
Yes, I don't like that movie, but yes, he did lots of movies with Tornatore, like a dozen or something like that. He worked with people again and again. Clint Eastwood asked him to do a movie and he said no, which he's bummed that he didn't say yes to that. I don't know why. He thought he was too busy or something and he didn't do it. Kubrick asked him to do A Clockwork Orange, but Sergio Leone said, no, he's too busy and wouldn't let him do it. He really wasn't too busy, but he just didn't want him to work for Kubrick. And so he didn't. He did 500 films overall, 500 plus, I'm sure. Noted for allowing a single instrument, I think, to shine. You can remember like the oboe in The Mission or wow, wow, wow. You know, that one instrument in the spaghetti westerns. He did that again and again.
Like that piccolo.
Yeah, yes. Yeah, exactly. And I had a fun thing with Warren Beatty. Got to interview Warren Beatty once. And Bugsy came up and the score of Ennio Morricone. And I said, oh, yeah, I loved it. I loved it even more. I loved it all just as much when he did it in State of Grace, which was the movie that came out early. You know, people recycle their themes and stuff. And State of Grace had a lot of stuff in common with what he did on Bugsy. And
I love State of Grace, that movie. I like that movie.
And Beatty just, of course, you know, just Sphinx-like, said nothing, you know.
Yeah, he is very good at that, by the way.
He is indeed. So I said, no, yeah, I thought it was used better in Bugsy. It's a great, you know, so there you go. But he's not the only one. A lot of other people died. Screenwriter Louis John Carlino, he died at 88. He's an Oscar nominee, a multiple winner of WGA nominee. Best known, of course, for The Great Santini. Classic film, not a cult film. I don't think that's quite the right word for it, but just a very well-respected movie based on the novel by Pat Conroy. Just a really, you know, great stuff. But interesting because he did great adaptations and great originals. You tend to have, you know, a strength in comedy or drama or adapting stuff or writing original stuff. And he did it all. He did it all. He did it from working in television, where he did a live TV, like the first episode of the CBS Television Workshop. Well, that wasn't probably live. It was in 1960, but he wrote for Route 66. He created TV shows, but mostly films. The cult favorite Seconds, starring Rock Hudson and directed by John Frankenheimer. That is a cult favorite. The Mechanic, starring Charles Bronson, which famously began with a wordless 16-minute scene. 16 minutes. That's pretty awesome. He worked for Roger Corman. He did this film, the cult 1980 film Resurrection. He hung out with actress Ellen Burstyn, who had this idea for a movie about a woman who got in a car accident. Her husband dies. She survives and ends up having healing powers. And he met with her. He hung out with her for like a weekend or something, workshopping the idea. And then he went home and wrote it in 3 weeks. That's a really interesting film. And then he directed Class from 1983, which gave key early roles to Andrew McCarthy. It was his film debut. And Rob Lowe, who had been in the ensemble of The Outsiders, but it still was a big early role for him. So he wrote, he directed that, and he wrote and directed, I believe, The Great Santini. So that's a pretty cool career.
Well, and, you know, if we can't spend, you know.
No, it won't be. I know.
So we have Earl Cameron.
Yes, a great British trailblazing actor, but more importantly, a fellow Bermudian. He was born in Bermuda like me. He died at 92. He was the first leading man of color in the UK. He starred in Pool of Blood, a noir that was the first British film to feature an interracial romance. His film Sapphire won the BAFTA for Best Film. That was about prejudice. He had a little role in the James Bond film Thunderball, and it was pretty downhill from there. He just couldn't get good roles, even though he had a lot of talent. Modest roles and stuff like Inception, the Christopher Nolan film, and The Interpreter, and that was surely better than being in Simba or Tarzan the Magnificent, but never had a career that quite met up to that early success, unfortunately. Same goes true for Charles Webb. He's the author of The Graduate, the novel that was turned into the film. The novel's pretty good. The film is better, though I personally don't love it. But he died at 81, and he truly ran away from fame and money. I mean, really, he was born into money. He rejected his inheritance. He gave away any money he was forced to take. When The Graduate was a hit, he and his wife and they're like, no. They were in public housing at one point because he just refused to make money. He lived a completely bohemian, true to his principles life. This guy, if you read the obituary we linked to, a fascinating life that would kind of make a cool movie.
Well, and Charlie Daniels, I think, was his life already a movie? I don't know.
It was Urban Cowboy. No, he was the opposite of Urban Cowboy. He was a good old boy in the bad old sense of the word. He died at 83, Country Music Hall of Famer, began as a session musician, great fiddler, and he played on multiple Bob Dylan albums, including Nashville Skyline and Self Portrait, which was hated at the time, but the deluxe box set is revelatory. So he did great work, and then he helped merge country and Southern rock. You know, he had songs like The South's Gonna Do It Again. He was just as far right as you can get, but he has died at 83, had a lot of fans. And of course, his big hit, which I could sing to you, but I won't, The Devil Went Down to Georgia.
Well, okay.
Thank you for small favors, right? Did you know Steve Bing, the Hollywood financier and producer Steve Bing? He died by suicide, unfortunately, at the age of 55. This was really sad.
Yeah, I met him a couple of times, but I didn't know him, you know, like we weren't hanging out. No, I mean, you know, he hung out with Bill Clinton and Elizabeth Hurley. And yeah, he
seems like a guy that Hollywood would love. And I'm not trying to disparage him here, but he inherited a ton of money. He came to Hollywood, and by and large, he seemed to be the guy to be like, sure, I'll back your passion project. You know, it's just those things that you couldn't get made that people were like, yeah, no. He was like, okay, let's do it. So he backed Warren Beatty's film, Rules Don't Apply, Barry Levinson's Rock the Casbah, Albert Brooks's Looking for Comedy in the Muslim World, a lot of stuff that did not click, but he did some really good stuff too. He backed Robert Zemeckis's film, The Polar Express, which was certainly a commercial success and done much better since it came out. It's become a holiday perennial, not that I think it's very good, but you know, that motion capture stuff worked. And this is cool. He footed the bill for a Jerry Lee Lewis album, a duets album called Last Man Standing. That was probably his last hurrah. That got great rave reviews. I liked Young Blood a decade earlier. That was sort of a comeback album. I thought that was terrific.
Well, he also did the Rolling Stones documentary that Martin Scorsese directed.
Yeah, that was, you know, it was neither here nor there in my mind. It did fine at the theaters. It wasn't a flop or a big, you know, for a concert film, it made like $2-3 million, which is what you make on them. I don't know that he made money on it, though. I imagine he didn't, but I don't think he cared about that. So he did a lot of humanitarian causes. It's sad to hear he suffered and fought depression, I guess. And hopefully anybody who needs help knows, don't keep it to yourself. Reach out. There's help to be had.
Well, I would have loved to have met Milton Glaser, who died at the age of 91. He's a graphic designer, best known for the iHeart logos for New York, the iHeart New York logo. Of course, now it's everywhere. iHeart everything.
Yeah, no, he wrote it in the back of a taxi cab, scribbled it on a napkin, famously. You can see the image if you look up the obituary we linked to. Hundreds of posters. He did tons of commercial advertising. He did the poster for Angels in America on Broadway. And speaking of Dylan, we just talked to him. He was a part of Charlie Daniels' obit. Here he is again, because Milton Glaser designed a psychedelic poster of Bob Dylan that was included in Bob Dylan's greatest hits. To this day, if you buy one old copy of that and it's sealed, or you're lucky enough that they left it in there, you can find that poster. Millions of them went up. Not that that album sold millions, but it was also sold separately. Millions of those went up in dorm rooms and bedrooms all over America and the world.
I did not have a poster of newsman Hugh Downs, however, who died at the age of 99. He is without a doubt known for 2020 with Barbara Walters and the Today Show.
He's a nice guy, but listen to this career. You know, he had success every step of the way. He's a nice guy. I don't think of him particularly as a news. He's just sort of a face on TV. You trust him. He's a sidekick, an anchor who, you know, in the next story, you know, but he didn't seem to have a strong, you know, he wasn't a newsman as such, even though he hosted a lot of news shows. He wasn't breaking stories at all, but cool. He started as an announcer on the kids show Kukla, Fran, and Ollie. That's a classic show. And in fact, he was so nervous, he was worried people would hear the paper shaking in his hand as he read from his script. Then he became the sidekick to Jack Parr on The Tonight Show, and he guest hosted that more than anyone else. He thought they might offer him the show, but they gave it to this kid named Johnny Carson. He hosted the game show Concentration. And here's the cool thing. He hosted the Today Show. And when they were looking to bring on a co-host, he said, well, what about her? They're like, no, she's Barbara Walters. She's just a writer. He's like, no, I think she'd be good. And he insisted they were not going to do it. He insisted they bring her on air. She got like once a week, she'd get a little spot. Then it became twice a week. Then it became three. Then, you know, history was made. And, you know, they had a great time on the Today Show. She broke ground there. Then she ultimately went on to do the evening news, and it was a disaster. It was a flop. And when that fell through, she went right on to 2020 with Hugh Downs as well. They co-hosted that show side by side. So he was an important player in her career. They had decades together on the air. In fact, he did more than 10,000 hours of television. He held the record until somebody passed him in 2004. That's Regis. So there you go. What an interesting, long, memorable career.
Johnny Mandel had a long and memorable career too. He died at the age of 94.
He'd be famous just for being an arranger.
Yeah, I know.
I mean, I know. Frank Sinatra, Peggy Lee, Michael Jackson, Tony Bennett, Barbara Streisand, Shirley Horn, Mel Torme, Diana Krall. He was a great, great arranger, but he also wrote stuff, didn't he?
Yeah, he wrote actually maybe the best known for the theme song to MASH, Suicide is Painless, which, that's by right. The way, the lyrics to that, Robert Altman's movie, right? His 15-year-old son wrote those lyrics.
Well, yeah, so that song was used in the film Suicide is Painless, and then they took it and made it just an instrumental and used it for the TV show. Oh, that's a lot of money. He did a lot of other film scores like The Sandpiper, Being There, great movie, Death Trap. The score is probably the best thing in that little movie, The Verdict. His most important film score was probably the jazz-influenced work he did on I Want to Live with Susan Hayward. I always think of A Streetcar Named Desire as having a really groundbreaking jazz influence score, but I Want to Live is right up there as well. Oh, and early on, he was an arranger. I'm giving you a softball here. I'm giving you a layup. He was an arranger on Sid Caesar's variety series, Your Show of Shows.
I didn't know what you were referring to when you said layup. You know, I was like, what is he talking about? Like, why is that a layup? But then I said, okay, wait a second. Sid Caesar's Show of Shows, who was one of the writers on that? Who was in the writer's room? You know who was in the writer's room on that? Carl Reiner, comedian, writer, Carl Reiner, who died at the age of 98. A beloved figure. He was a performer on that show, Your Show of Shows.
Yeah, he was a writer and a performer, exactly.
He created the Dick Van Dyke Show.
One of the great sitcoms of all time, especially because it combined home and work. Unlike few shows before or since, people always thought, well, you can't do work and home. You had to choose. And so you know, shows were set at work or they were set at home. And one, you know, you didn't do both. And they did it great on the Dick Van Dyke Show. He had a rich home life, a rich work life. Some episodes would be all at home. Others would be all at work. Sometimes they cross back and forth. But really, one of the smartest sitcoms, really intelligent show, pulled the plug after five seasons very wisely. They were running out of steam, but a very smart, good show.
And, you know, probably without a doubt, one of his biggest hits, The 2,000-Year-Old Man, which was a comedy skit that he did with Mel Brooks, his friend, until the bitter end. Literally.
No, there's no reason to say it was bitter till the very end.
To the very end, yes. They were together, actually, when Carl Reiner died.
Oh, I did not know that.
Yeah, and now, actually, I know that we could say, look, he was the father of Rob Reiner. He did
did a lot of Steve Martin movies, The Jerk, All of Me. He did Oh God with George Burns. He starred on Broadway, acted in Ocean's 11, Emmys, Grammys, the Mark Twain Prize. A great, great career. Oh, he's in Comedians with Cars, and that's where the story comes from, doesn't it?
Yeah, and I guess Reiner had invited Jerry. This is a quote. He invited Jerry to come over and have dinner with Mel Brooks and himself. According to Reiner, every night, Brooks heads to Reiner's house to eat, watch Jeopardy, which he tapes, and watch movies. The one rule for movies, it has to be a movie where somebody says, secure the perimeter, or get some rest. Brooks said, falls asleep with his mouth open every time.
Yeah, I mean, he had famous dinners with him and Mel Brooks and Sid Caesar and others. And you're just like, oh God, I'd love to sit there. I'd love to get invited to that dinner. They got together all the time. Mel Brooks, every night. I taped Jeopardy too, watch it with my mom and my brother. So that's kind of sweet. So yeah, great career, great talent. Super nice guy. Never met him, but from all accounts, you know, a mensch.
I did meet him once. Actually, I met him with Rob Reiner.
He said, my car is the one on the left.
No. No. They were at the Magno Sound at a screening, and uh-huh. They were just standing. I was like, oh, look, it's Rob Reiner. And he's talking to, well, that's his father, Carl Reiner. So that makes sense.
And you push Rob out of the way. We go, Carl, you're the best.
No, I mean, you know, I didn't say anything. I just said, hey, you know, big fan.
Yeah. Very cool. What a great story, Sperling.
Yes, and you can hear more of our stories if you subscribe to us in iTunes, the Google Play Store, Microsoft Marketplace, Stitcher, anywhere they give podcasts away for free. You can rate and review the show on any one of those podcast aggregators. It does help us out when you do. Links to all of the stories we discussed on today's episode can be found on our website, showbizsandbox.com. That's where you'll find those ways to subscribe to us or ways to contact us. You can email us dirt@showbizsandbox.com. That's dirt@showbizsandbox.com. Or you can call and leave us a voicemail. The number to call is 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263. We're on Twitter where our handle is @showbizsandbox or on Facebook, facebook.com/showbizsandbox. The music that you hear at the beginning and end of each show is by the popular indie rock group MGMT. They can be found on their own website, whoismgmt.com. Michael Giltz can be found online, and every week he's got a new and exciting website for us. What is it this week, Michael?
This week it's freefrosty.com, which may take you to Wendy's, but I mean it to be about Frosty the Snowman.
Well, you know, if you can't find any of Michael's coverage of the entertainment industry there, why not head on over to michaelgiltz.com, where all of his coverage and work can be found. Some of my work can be found on Celluloid Junkie. Until next week, play nice.
I have nothing against Jason Momoa. He may be great, but it doesn't seem like good casting. And
it really doesn't.
He's getting good work. So God bless. I mean, he's a nice guy. Our friend Jeff Bezos says he's great. He's a rock star. He's wonderful. And like, God bless him. He's Aquaman. That ain't easy. But, you know, Frosty, I don't get it.
You know, he lives.
He lives around the corner from you because everybody does.
Well, he lives up on Mulholland Highway. And
not Mulholland Drive. What a bummer. You know, it's cooler to be on Mulholland Drive.
Well, you know, I guess the mail doesn't come up to him. And so at this UPS store, there were all these packages that said Jason Momoa and his address. And I was like, you know, guys, you might want to like turn those packages around or like put them in the back or something. You shouldn't really like have this guy's address just like out in the open.
Oh, it's his home address, not the UPS address. Oh, he doesn't just get stuff there and then pick it up.
Right, exactly.
Because I wouldn't use my home address. I would just have it sent to,
I don't know what it was. Yeah.
Oh, okay. But it was showing his real address, you mean?
Yeah.
Oh, you're like, yeah, that's not cool. They're like, oh, whatever. We got a lot of celebrities.
Maybe I'm going to go over there and try and talk him out of being, in Frosty.
Like, really? He go, no, listen to me. I am Frosty. I am so Frosty. He may nail it. Who knows?